And we are back with an all new episode of Keep It. I'm Ira Madison III.
I'm Louis Rotel, and it's as if we never said goodbye, quoth the musical Sunset Boulevard, which I am proud to announce I am seeing this weekend in New York City. I cannot wait. And I'll tell you why I can't wait. One, most people seem to fucking love Nicole Scherzinger as Norma Desmond. But two, The review in the New York Times was the one non-rave. And the mid-questioning, skeptical vibe of that review makes me want to see it more. I'm kind of confused. But most people seem to love Nicole.
Yeah, I was with a friend yesterday for lunch, my friend Noah, and he was telling me that he was at the premiere and that it was fucking amazing and that it sort of does Ivan Van Hove, but better.
Oh, I see. That's the guy who does like spooky theatrical retellings of things we're all familiar with. He also
using cameras and screens and ruining West Side Story.
And also he did, speaking of the films of 1950s, Sunset Boulevard, he's the one who did the version of All About Eve that had Lily James in it and Gillian Anderson. And people were like, I'm not sure we needed this.
It was a
either.
Version.
Yeah. And the music of PJ Harvey, whom I touted last week. Anyway, I rewatched the 1950s Sunset Boulevard this week. Which apparently, Gloria Swanson in that movie playing this fading movie star who a down-on-his-luck screenwriter kind of runs into, and they both try to rehabilitate each other, and then she gets crazier, and it's this film noir experience. I'm sure you've seen it. But do you know what the scariest part of that movie is? It's not when she becomes violent or highly delusional. The scariest part of that movie is when Norma Desmond out of nowhere goes, I've written a screenplay, and then just pulls it out. Like, what on earth are you writing? Who gave her a typewriter?
You know, Norma Desmond would have hated podcasts.
Oh, no.
We didn't need dialogue. We had faces.
Oh, picture her sitting with the Victrola and our voices are coming out of it. Absolutely not.
That is a fantastic movie.
Oh, yeah. You know what's shocking about that movie is that it's so watchable and intense and suspenseful, even though most of the movie is him doing voiceover. Like, he's telling you what's happening and telling you this guy's inner monologue. I'm talking about William Holden here, who had an amazing 1950 because he starred in that. And he also starred in the movie that won Best Actress, beating Gloria Swanson, Born Yesterday with Judy Holliday. So anyway, that's how you do the year 1950. Thank you, William Holden.
I mean, it's interesting you bring up the voiceover too, because I think that obviously that was a film noir trope at the time, and there are certain movies where obviously it's overdone and it feels like it shouldn't work, and maybe that's because these were maybe the originators where you sort of don't mind. I'm thinking of Billy Wilder directed Sunset Boulevard, and I'm also thinking of Double Indemnity as well.
That's definitely the best film noir movie, definitely.
Yeah, and the best one that handles voiceover.
Yeah, right.
You know? But it just works in these movies, you know? And it also feels like the voiceover feels like a character. It feels, I mean, to bring up a podcast, you know, it feels like you're listening to something that is propulsive. It feels like a story is being told. It feels like you've got a beginning, middle, and end. You know, there's urgency to it. I feel like a lot of voiceover in movies since then is just people talking.
Right. And also just like a way to make the story relatable in too obvious a way. Like, you know, like here's your friend in the movie leading you in or whatever. And also it's a little bit of a Gone Girl situation where the person in the voiceover, it's like, do we like this person? What's going on here? And, you know, because he's deeply cynical. The point of view of the movie is extremely cynical. Anyway.
Also, great opening.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Yes, exactly. And you have no idea how you're going to get there. It begins with a pool. Also, the other thing that's awesome about the original movie, and I wonder how much of this is preserved in the stage show, which is, of course, written by Andrew Lloyd Webber and is not the exact same thing as the movie. The references to older movie stars, like it constantly is like, you know, it's a movie that takes place in the Hollywood system. So you're talking to writers who are like, oh, could we get a Tyrone Power type in this role? You know, I love that. People referencing the feel of being in the business You know, it's what Ryan Murphy's Hollywood was going for. And I don't know that I would put it on the same level as Sunset Boulevard, but.
I actually appreciate that about films of that era too. It's a thing that people reference all the time. It's not a new observation, but about like Shakespeare, for instance, right? It's you when people try to not say like a 30 Rock or something for making contemporary pop culture jokes, it's Shakespeare was doing that too. Sunset Boulevard was doing that too. It's just that we don't recognize the references anymore.
Right. You have to look a lot of it up. Like some of them don't seem like contemporary references or whatever, but a total pleasure. And also great fall viewing right in my intrigue pocket that I was talking about last week.
I actually was going to ask like your favorite Billy Wilder film, but I think mine's Double Indemnity. I think it's just obvious for
yeah,
me.
Yeah, I mean, lots of good answers.
Or The Apartment.
Lots of good answers. Yeah, I love The Apartment. I mean, I think I would say Sunset Boulevard because it's got four awesome characters. I even love this screenwriter chick who has like a subplot that's like the least interesting part of the movie, but her like Hollywood ambitions are very real. Also, and she talks about how she grew up in Hollywood. I love the flourishes of that character. And she was like 20 years old at the time, got an Oscar nomination. Her name is Nancy Olson. She lived until about last year. Like you could go to Sunset Boulevard screenings and an original cast member of that movie, an adult, would be at the screening.
Yeah. It's fun because I think also he's really good at, to bring up Double Indemnity, movies at that time where people playing against type. Obviously you have Barbara Stanwyck playing a femme fatale in Double Indemnity. And speaking of movies going against type, you know, to continue our Oscar season rolling along, I saw Gladiator 2 last night.
Oh, my God. I have to say, when these movies are unmasked to us well ahead of time and we get these screenings and we get to see them like two months ahead, I almost, it's like opening your Christmas presents early. Like, I need to save some of these for the big moment because you want to be a part of the discussion when they occur. That said, this is like the biggest epic of the season. So what did you think?
It's the only epic.
Yeah, I mean, like, we do have Wicked, and we do have Dune 2, which occurred, you know, but...
Yeah. Honestly, I mean, there's a lot of talk about how men cry during the first one.
Yeah.
It's a man movie that allows men to be in touch with their feelings. I cried during this movie, too.
Oh, God. Wow. Would you say it's better than the first one?
No, it's very different. It's a sequel, but it's more, I would actually say it's a Scream 2 to Gladiator Scream.
Oh, okay. So that means,
if that makes sense.
That means it ups the stakes, but keeps the same suspense you know and love. And there's a couple of haircuts that make you want to scream.
And, Denzel Washington is very similar to Laurie Metcalf, actually. Okay. In this movie, his performance with the rings and the robes, the dress that he's talked about already in his interviews. Actually, you know what I described Denzel Washington as? I was sitting next to writers Michael Cuby and Hunter Harris during a screening. And first of all, we cracked up at every single Denzel line. I know the theater was sick of us, but they weren't bad. They weren't like, you know, like, oh, this is so bad. Like, we're laughing. They were like perfect line readings. Like, it is Denzel's movie.
I would say, when's the last time you've ever reacted or we've ever reacted to a Denzel performance like that? I'm so psyched. It sounds like
Training Day.
It sounds like a delicious performance, quoth Cate Blanchett talking about Judi Dench in No Ton of Scandal.
It's maybe his most delicious performance since Training Day. And he is giving, I kid you not, Nichelle Nichols in Truck Turner.
Allow me to slow down because you just said that. Nichelle Nichols.
If you told me his inspiration was Nichelle Nichols in the movie Truck Turner, then I would believe you.
Oh my God. I have like a splitting happy migraine because you said that. That's so shocking. How's Paul Mescal, who, as you know, I believe his energy is he's 1'7". And he wears tiny little shorts from like Zara alone, but then an expensive blouse.
But he's so tall in person.
He is. Okay.
I ran into him in the theater. He was there for a talk back, as well as Connie Nelson. And Denzel was there as well.
Jesus.
He's great. I mean, he's bulky. He's good. He gives man. You know, he really sort of transforms in a way that I wasn't expecting, that you wouldn't expect from normal people after Son Paul.
Oh, yes.
You know?
Also, by the way, this is in Gladiator 2, there's a scene where they put sharks into the amphitheater or whatever. And this is like loosely based on something that could have occurred at one point because they did flood the Roman amphitheater at some point. That said, putting sharks, I mean, it's like Dr. Evil level. I mean, what's happening here? Girl, you know there weren't sharks in that. Come on. What book did you get that from? Ridley.
Yeah. I had a big fucking great time.
Oh my God. I'm so psyched. I mean, and speaking of Oscars, we'll be talking this episode about Anora, the new Sean Baker movie starring Mikey Madison. And I've got to tell you, the best actress race this year is very intriguing to me because nobody is really jumping to the fore in terms of has to win. I mean, Mikey Madison is such a new name. We know her from Scream 5 and we know her from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. But this performance, which I think is mesmerizing and fabulous, it would be so weird if someone won an Oscar for being that new. I mean, we haven't had one of those in a while, particularly in the best actress category.
Speaking of Scream.
Yes.
Mikey Madison, one of my favorite recent Ghostface killers.
She inhabited what a killer should be in the movie. When she's unmasked and what you learn who this person is. Yes.
Yes. Also, did you know, I mean, you're not a TikToker, but her moment at the end where she's confessing to Gail that she killed Dewey, like she calls him a pussy, is a trending reaction on TikTok.
Oh.
Like people acting out that scene. It's so fucking funny.
We have put Gail through it. Jesus Christ.
Can't believe that bitch is coming back for another movie. Yeah,
no kidding.
Her and Sydney.
My God.
What are they doing?
They should come with like head bandages and like smoke. I mean, the most jaded people who ever lived. And nonetheless, I am very excited to see Nev and Courtney again in those movies. Okay, so we've got Anora. What else is happening this episode, Ira?
Well, unfortunately, Liam Payne passed away this week.
What a mind-boggling headline. Had to read it 3 times. I was in the middle of a meeting at work and had to announce it to 15 other writers. And we were in the middle of like an actual pitch or something at the moment. It was over. I was immediately going through the 1D archives after that. What a shocking and sad story.
Announcing it to people and then also the shock of, we'll talk about it, but the initial shock of just how it was presented to us via TMZ with photos of his dead body.
Insane. I still haven't seen them.
Yeah. They were partial, but it was horrifying. And so that news sort of like came out of really, I mean, obviously like a death comes out of nowhere a lot of times, but it is weird to just be in the social media era where this man was, there are photos of him like online or like Instagram stories of him in Buenos Aires, truly like an hour, 2 hours at an event before he died.
Oh, no. I mean, he was on Snapchat like a half hour beforehand or something. It was wild. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about that and revisit One Direction as well. And we have a wonderful guest this week. We have Tegan Quinn of Tegan and Sarah joining us this week. Now, Tegan and Sarah were actually early Keep It guests.
I was not here for that, unfortunately. Yeah. Yes. I mean, I was, I don't know where I was, on assignment. What was I doing? But
in Kiev.
Yeah, correct. Tegan is in a new documentary on Hulu called Fanatical about a wild story of privacy invasion that occurred regarding Tegan and Sarah years ago, before we became sophisticated about this sort of thing. And it's a harrowing tale.
Yeah. So we're going to chat with Tegan and welcome her back to Keep It in just a bit. But when we're back, we'll talk about One Direction. Staying on top of the news you need to know for this election is more important and chaotic than ever. Luckily, the Crooked Media News team has you covered with What a Day, a fresh podcast, first thing when you wake up, and a nightly recap newsletter. It's the perfect match, like Donald Trump in jail.
Plus, our newsletter just got a refresh, new design, same great insights. Be prepared for this high-stakes election season. Subscribe to the What a Day podcast and newsletter at crooked.com/daily.
We are days away from the election, and this race will come down to a few thousand votes in a handful of battleground states. The most effective messengers in these final days are not people like us, because we live in New York and California, baby. They're people like you,
So we need everyone listening, we need you to think of three people you know who live in battleground states like Arizona, Nevada, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, or Georgia, and make sure they vote. Scroll through your contacts list, find those names, and text them or call them. Then do that five more times before Election Day. We're not kidding. Reminders work.
And if you don't know anyone in those states, you definitely know three people who could use a nudge to vote, no matter where they live. And if you don't know what to say in those texts, DMs, and calls, go to votesaveamerica.com/vote, where you can sign up to get scripts that you can put in your own words and send to your friends. Just go to votesaveamerica.com/vote and click Get the Script to get started.
This message has been paid for by Vote Save America. You can learn more at votesaveamerica.com. This ad has not been authorized by any candidate or candidates committee.
Last Wednesday, former One Direction member Liam Payne died in Buenos Aires after falling from a hotel balcony. The singer was only 31, and since his death, his friends and fans have flooded the internet with remembrances of his talent. Today, we're going to take a look back at Liam's legacy and at One Direction's everlasting impact on pop culture.
Let's just reiterate what a tragedy this was. We talked about how we both heard, and then we were immediately flooded with images from TMZ that were showed parts of his body there. I mean, like it wasn't graphic to the point where you see face or anything like that, but it was unbelievably shocking. So one, you were confronted with this horrible news, and then two, you were confronted with how we get this kind of news, which was just insane. But thinking about One Direction, I mean, like as we've been talking about, Billboard has done a list of like the 25 biggest pop stars of the 21st century, and One Direction was listed, I think, somewhere in the 19 range or something. They were not just an undeniable phenomenon, like, you weirdly got to know all five of them in a way that I feel like you didn't even really with something like NSYNC. Like, they all had distinct personalities and what they contributed to the band. Like, you know what Niall contributed, you know what Zayn contributed, we can compare all of their solo output. All five of them were discoveries on X Factor. They were put together into one supergroup, and then they became the phenomenon that they were. And it was they were also charming together. And then also, it seemed to sour pretty immediately, too. It seemed like all five of them had an experience with the group that was immediately overwhelming, as they had four consecutive Billboard albums that also all went to number one. I feel like as long as they've been famous and long as they've been adored, there's also been this, like, checkered, they got too big too fast, is always been my perception of One Direction. Though if I had to pick a favorite song of theirs, it would be one that Liam co-wrote. And this is a low-key karaoke banger. When you put this on, everybody sings it. The best One Direction song is Night Changes.
That's a great song. That's a great song. You know, I love No Control.
Interesting choice. Do you know what I was just confronted with? Okay, so did they have an early song called Little Things?
Yes.
I had never heard this song before. It has like 500 million views or whatever. And like, you watch it, and I don't think of One Direction as an old boy band. Obviously, they occurred like 14, 15 years ago. Watching that video, you feel like you are watching New Kids on the Block. You realize how young they were, how like the hairs and the look like have changed and evolved like extremely over the years. And obviously, they're not like teenagers anymore. Mm-hmm. But wow, it's just, it's mind-blowing to be confronted with how young they were and how in control of being, like, singers and songwriters they were even then, even though they were thrust into the spotlight.
I mean, even from the What Makes You Beautiful video to the Kiss You video, which is, like, you know, two different albums, they just, this complete sort of, like, glow up and sort of image change. And we did really get to watch them grow up. And I'm glad you brought up Night Changes. I love that song. I love Story of My Life as well. That's another sort of karaoke banger. Night Changes is a great song that Liam did co-write. And I think I wrote about this at my Substack last week, the fact that Liam was a songwriter. And what was really interesting and that a lot of people didn't know about a lot of their songs was that Liam and Lewis, the majority of the songs in One Direction were co-written by both of them. You know, they were the chief songwriters in the group. Obviously, sometimes like Harry would write a few things, and Zayn as well. And then the other one was there. But, you know, I think that really Liam contributed a lot to the songwriting of One Direction and sort of what the group sounded like, really. And as they matured and as he matured and as their relationships actually changed, I think that once we got to Midnight Memories, once we got to Four is a fantastic album, mm-hmm. by the way. I think just start to finish is a great rock album. It sounds like a mature rock band, and you get to see, you know, all of the growth that they've had as artists.
He was also one half of what I believe is the only reality show judge and contestant relationship I can think of. He was with Cheryl Cole, famously of Girls Aloud. They have a child together.
Yes. Now, she was a judge on X Factor when he first started on X Factor.
Correct.
We don't have to talk about that.
Moving on. Girls, be quiet.
We could also be quiet about the time she beat up a bathroom attendant.
Oh, did that happen?
Yes.
I've always like connected to her because she sort of is like if Kate Beckinsale were a pop star. That is her energy to me.
I mean, that's her general vibe.
Yeah. Gay men who don't stand Kate Beckinsale, unacceptable. Love Kate Beckinsale. Moving on.
I mean, I think I've told this story once before that I think Beyonce had told Kate Beckinsale once that Serendipity was one of her favorite movies.
Could that be less shocking? That's so right. Love and Friendship is the best Kate Beckinsale movie, followed by Last Days of Disco. Moving on. Yeah.
Her sitting at home watching that fall movie with John Cusack and Kate. It's a classic.
Yep. In recent years, Liam Payne was with this model influencer, Maya Henry. They had a falling out that seemed very serious. Like she had been, he had been trying to reach out to her for years and years. She rejected it. It felt like there's a darkness surrounding Liam Payne in his recent years. And like the toxicology report from the autopsy was downright harrowing. It was basically a list of everything you'd expect in a harrowing toxicology report. But the nature of his death, like the, as we said before, we saw him on social media so recently before that, that it must have felt like some sort of manic moment or something. Like it's a very, it's once you start thinking about it, like a lot of theories flood your brain. It just a lot is possible, and it's all extremely tragic.
Yeah, what's interesting about One Direction, I want to say, is that I remember them starting out, obviously, with the X Factor and the What Makes You Beautiful era, and particularly being, maybe we were a little too old for them at that point, but they had a sort of gay fan base, but then they sort of grew up into adults, and what really happened is that I think maybe it was because of these sort of shifting ideas of pop music in general. You know, I think a lot of people started taking pop music more seriously. Music critics started to, like the Pitchfork sort of crew started taking pop music more seriously as well. I think that One Direction started being respected a bit more as pop artists. The music got better, for one. And I think that we started respecting them as a group more right around Four and Midnight Memories. Like the songs were great, the writing was good, in sort of a way that it took a while for people to sort of retroactively like the songs of, say, NSYNC or Backstreet Boys or Britney Spears, you know?
Yeah. Well, also, I mean, like, this is a weird comparison, but like, if when people talk about the Beatles, if they had stayed the same kind of music they made in like 1964, like the Please Please Me, like I Want to Hold Your Hand, they would have shriveled so much faster. Like they needed to evolve in order to not just like keep their fan base, but expand it and like gain respect ultimately, you know? And also they basically lasted about the same amount of time. It was like a 6 or 7 year period that One Direction was extremely popular in. I will say, if I had to pick a greatest solo moment from any One Direction member, I think I have to go with This Town by Niall. I think that's the best of the solo outputs. And I'm, by the way, I'm ignoring all of Harry's House. I know we're supposed to love Harry's House. Album of the Year winner, Harry's House. But This Town is a banger single.
Well, you know, we don't really listen to Harry on this podcast. But I love Liam. Strip That Down
was definitely his best work. Liam also released one of the most derided albums of the past six, seven, 8 years or so.
LP one.
Yeah, a shockingly bad album. Which I don't know. I mean, like, I think about that moment a lot, actually, because obviously there was this halcyon days period of One Direction where, you know, seemingly everything they touched turned to gold. And then you have an album of your own and it flops. I mean, like, what does that fill you with? Like, do you hate the fans for turning on you? Do you hate critics for turning on you? Like, you know, it just, it went so awry in a way. I wonder how detached you can be from that kind of failure.
Really am remembering that era, and that album was dragged to hell and back.
In a way that nobody expected. I mean, there's so many people that, like, we're sort of prepared to drag. Like, oh, here comes this person again with their middling efforts or whatever. But I think nobody expected that album to be like that. You know, no one expected him to be, like, the butt of a joke at that moment.
Yeah, and it's interesting that I feel like when Zayn first came out, his first album was pretty good.
Yeah.
I think it was well received. And then, if anything, I would say that Zayn's music didn't really become, it wasn't critically derided. I would say it's sort of just filtered into the background.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
You know, Zayn would release something and you would sort of maybe find it on Spotify in like New Music Friday or something, but it was less an event as it was for Mind of Mine was like a big event in 2016.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you know, Pillow Talk, a number one hit. Like, we expected Zayn to be the breakout star for years and years and years, and now I'm like Googling, remember Zayn.
And it's, I don't know, looking back at, obviously, you know, a lot of the struggles that all of them had coming out of One Direction, Liam and Zayn were both people who sort of seemed to struggle with being in the group. They were the two people who sort of derided the group publicly and spoke ill of the group, or you sort of put their contributions to the group higher than everyone else's. And I would say that Zayn is at least someone who seems to have gotten past that hump of a lot of the issues that he was dealing with post One Direction, but Liam still seemed to be stuck in a lot of them post One Direction.
If you haven't read Remembrances of Liam Payne, one that I found really touching was Lewis Tomlinson, who talked, first of all, he referred to him as Payno, which I guess is a nickname they had for him. So it's just immediately endearing, and you get a real sense of the relationship they had because of One Direction and in spite of One Direction, like how they forged a real bond, even though the crucible of tension and expectations placed on that group would, I think, naturally split them all apart. It was cool to see that they still had some sort of communications about working together again.
And it's important to remember that this wasn't a group that was friends who came together and were making music in their garage or something. You know, this is the very unique phenomenon of these people were put together by Simon Cowell.
Right.
On X Factor.
Much like, as you can see on my shirt, if you're watching this on YouTube, Cat's Eye, which is still on Popstar Academy, which you can watch on Netflix. Why is this not the most popular show on Netflix? Why? It's so mind-boggling.
Please watch it.
Yeah.
Please watch it so they'll release another song.
Right. And like, I can say the words like, Daniela's my favorite today, and you'll understand it. Please. Yeah.
Well, you have to use K-pop terminology, Lewis, and you have to say your bias is Daniela.
Oh, man, I'm deeply unfamiliar. I need to like Urban Dictionary, all of that.
Yeah, your bias is that's who your favorite is.
Okay, got it. Cute. I'll remember that. You're like Who Weekly today, telling me all about this, the terms I don't know.
But yeah, you know, I mean, they were put together, and it's we experienced some of that in our early pop music that we listened to. But I mean, obviously, some of NSYNC and Backstreet Boys, a couple of those members were put in there by Lou Pearlman. But still, the core of those groups were people who had grown up together or were related and sort of had bonds that are still strong, you know, going into adulthood. One Direction, for all intents and purposes, like, have no reason to still interact with one another once One Direction is done, you know?
Right, they were fan cast.
But they still do.
They were fan cast. You know, like, we watched them each audition and be like, oh, that hairstyle belongs with that hairstyle. Let's put them together. Like, it was downright impersonal in a way.
And it is just a weird way to make music. you know? And but it is sort of how we make music corporately now. And I think it's just sort of beautiful that something came out of this fan casting moment from X Factor, a group that means a lot to so many people. I mean, you see all of the remembrances of Liam, all of the directioners writing about the time when they were writing One Direction fan fiction, or, you know, going to concerts. And this was like, you know, you're thinking about the Eras tour this past year, you know, that like people were going to One Direction concerts like they were going to the Eras tour.
Yeah, right. Anyway, Liam Payne was 31 years old. It's just, he's shockingly young. I mean, it's just an unbelievably tragic story that it still hasn't quite hit me. Even reading the One Direction statement about it still feels extremely strange. And at any rate, the music will live on because it is some of the most popular music of the 21st century.
Yeah, I was actually kind of shocked this weekend to hear some of the One Direction songs that I was hearing played either in a bar or at a party by people who you sort of wouldn't expect listen to One Direction. But as it turned out, friends of yours listen to One Direction, or at least they were so popular that people have one or two One Direction songs that they kind of love that maybe you never knew that they even listened to.
Yeah. Well, also, it's like it's filtered into the canon in a way. We're divorced from the moment of it. Now we can just respect the fact that they did give us big pop musical hooks and stuff, you know?
Yeah. And obviously, we're going to talk about this later with when Tegan Quinn joins us. But there is just something so weird about losing Liam and then just the urgency which with people need it, demand it, like a response from Harry and Niall and Zay. You know, it's like, I don't want to know what any of them think. I know what they think, you know?
Right.
They lost someone who was important to them. I don't need a statement from them on Instagram.
Right. No, they don't owe anybody comforting. It's very strange. You're right. And when Tegan's here, we'll discuss what fans can reasonably expect from artists and also what they can't expect, which is a wide array of shit.
We will be right back with Tegan Quinn of Tegan and Sarah. If it wasn't for this week's guest, pop music wouldn't be what it is today. As one half of the iconically queer, artistically singular duo Tegan and Sarah, her music has paved the way for other queer women to dominate the charts. But while many people have said they wanted to be Tegan and Sarah, one of them actually tried it. So here to talk about the new Hulu documentary, Fanatical, and her catfishing saga that inspired it, please welcome back to Keep It, Tegan.
Yay, I'm so glad to be back. And without Sarah, what a joy.
Liberation. Yes, finally.
Liberation.
Your moment is here.
Usually we have to, like, you know, share the questions and, like, keep our answers short. Man, what a joyful thing. Thank goodness for fake Tegan. That's one positive I can say from someone pretending to be me and trying to destroy me and dozens of other people's lives is now I get to do press alone.
We had the Veronicas here not too long ago, and it's interesting.
Oh,
I mean, you would obviously relate to this, but it's so interesting watching them like sort the question. Like, they instinctively know that sometimes you have to wait for the other one to speak first, and then there's like a whole choreography to it that I'm sure is maddening.
Yeah, you know what's interesting is, like, I mean, people will, the two things that I find kind of annoying is when someone will ask one of us a question, well, ask a question generally, so not direct it to one of us, and then one of us will answer it, and we've clearly covered it all, but then they'll look at the other one, waiting for the other one to respond, and we're like, no, we've got this figured out, bitch, like, don't worry about it, like, I'm gonna answer, you're gonna ask another question, she's gonna answer, and then the other thing is that it's not even like, I don't enjoy doing press with Sarah. It's just I've heard her answer these questions millions of times. So mostly I'm just thinking this isn't a productive use of my time because I'm just sitting here listening and I've already heard this.
Fegan would actually be also very valuable in this regard too. Just like answer the questions too. Let me move on with my life. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay. Starting talking about this movie. First of all, what a shocking saga. As we already said, it's a catfishing journey that happened somebody pretending to be you, reaching out to fans, forming close relationships with many fans, and having lots of your personal information. My question is, how did this turn into a movie? As in, were you, did you present it as an idea to somebody else? Or like, how did this come into, like, I can't even believe there's enough that happened that it would be cinematic, let alone this compelling.
Well, I suppose that's up for debate. But a couple years ago, I told the story to a friend of mine, and he was like, you know, sort of ensnared in me telling, like, I just started to unravel the story. I hadn't done that in a long time. You know, the active years of Fake Tegan that were most dominant were 2011 to 2015. And after that, I sort of tried to compartmentalize it. And it comes up all the time, but I hadn't told the story in a really long time. So this friend of mine let me tell this whole story. And then he suggested I write it down. So I wrote a story called Fake Tegan, and I pitched it to my agents as a podcast. I was sort of like very aspirational. Like, was like, we'll do a serial style podcast. We'll tell the story that we know, and then we'll sort of investigate in real time. And they thought it was a great idea. So I pitched it to this woman, Jenny Eliscu, who I'm friends with, who's a writer and host on Sirius. And she immediately called me after she read the story and said, let's pitch this to Aaron Lee Carr. And her and Aaron had just worked on a movie called Britney versus Spears. And Aaron Lee Carr is a very famous documentary filmmaker, has made now 10 films. And so we pitched her a couple weeks later, and she said, you guys, this is not a podcast. This is a movie. And we ended up joining forces with Story Syndicate, which is a big documentary production company, and went out and pitched it, and Hulu bought it. And for the last year and a half, we made a movie. And I had no idea if it was going to be worthy of a movie. There were definitely times where I thought, okay, this isn't going to work. But we were able to, you know, interview a dozen victims and obviously pull from archival and tell this really scary story that happened to us all these years ago.
It's so interesting to watch this because obviously you are, you know, reopening old wounds. And what's interesting too is the victims are as well. So, I mean, tell us a bit about the process of approaching these people to be a part of the documentary, and sort of had you had any contact with any of them in the time between, you know, the initial first scandal with Tegan, and then in the, you know, out of the blue, you know, you're messaging them and being like, be a part of this. Cause I know there's JT, who was a musician, who was a casual friend of yours, who had also become one of the catfishing victims, a victim of Tegan. And that's a big focal point about, you know, you two sitting down with one another.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. Honestly, back in the sort of 2011 to 2015 period, so that's when we first learned about Fake Tegan, and we started to communicate with the, you know, at the time, I think a couple dozen people had contacted our management. We'd put a call out saying, you know, if you've been talking to someone pretending to be Tegan, can you reach out? I never personally spoke to any of the victims at that time. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously, my relationship to all of the victims is complicated because all of them, for the most part, were online, you know, on message boards or Tumblr, like looking for my personal information, and then got into a friendship or relationship with me. And that's, you know, hard as a public figure. You're like, you need a line, you need a boundary. And so it was complicated. Mm-hmm. When this all first started, there was definitely a part of me that had less compassion and empathy and was just like, why are these people trying to get my personal information? Why do fans feel entitled to like breach our privacy? You know, so my management mostly dealt with it at the time. I was aware of everything that was going on and reading through everything and felt terrible for all these people, but I had never spoken to any of them. And I do think actually that was probably partly why I was interested in reinvestigating this and telling the story, was that I do have more compassion now, and I wanted to understand why these people got into these relationships and how this happened. So before we'd even sold the documentary, we spoke to Julie, who's the first victim that appears in the movie. And Julie had a multi-year, I think 3-year friendship with Fake Tegan, you know, exchanging thousands of emails and messages, and was devastated when she came forward. You know, she'd been given really personal information, passport scans, photos, unreleased demos of ours, and had become suspicious, had become kind of, you know, her instincts took over and she was like, this doesn't seem right. And had contacted our management. So she was our first call when we started to work on this project. And I was devastated for her. I still feel devastated. You know, she's so amazing and so sweet. And it's awful this happened to her. And she was the first person to agree to come on and talk about what happened. And so that was sort of our process going forward, was that, you know, there were some victims who'd had really long relationships, and they would, Aaron, who's the director, and Alyssa and Jenny, who are our main producers, you know, they would reach out to me and say, hey, we want to talk to Joanne. We want to talk to Julie. We want to talk to this person. Can we sort of say that you'd be up for speaking to them? And that was what landed us a lot of the victims. There were people who had very brief, you know, relationships with fake Tegan, who we didn't need for the film. There were other people who were deeply traumatized, who were not able to like revisit this in a way, like, you know, and didn't want to come public. Mm-hmm. And then Ira, of course, you bring up JT. JT, someone I went for coffee with a couple times in 2007 and had an old email of mine and had like reached out in like 2012 or 13 to be like, hey girl, let's connect again. And then ended up having a relationship with this person. And that was horrible. I mean, you know, when that all happened, when I found out about JT, that added a whole layer to the fake Tegan story that I wasn't even emotionally prepared for. You know, up to that point, it had just been Tegan and Sarah fans, you know, that this had affected. But when JT came forward, it opened this whole new can of worms, because I realized, oh my God, if someone's in my old email, who else were they talking to? And at that point, we investigated. I mean, we got Yahoo involved, and we found out there was like a dozen of my friends who had been talking to this person unknowingly and giving them access to personal information and photos. The only one who ended up having a relationship was JT, and, you know, ended up having a sexual relationship. And it was devastating for JT. I mean, it was mortifying and scary. And, you know, that part of the film and that part of the journey of reinvestigating this was really hard, obviously, because JT, similar to Tara, who's another victim in the film, their reaction to finding out that it wasn't me was the opposite of Julie. They weren't helpful at all. They were withholding, angry, you know, called me out publicly, accused me of terrible things, grooming underage fans. They were sharing naked photos, unreleased songs. I mean, they had a very different reaction to finding out about fake Tegan. So it was so helpful for me to revisit that 10 years later. And, you know, they had very different reactions now too. Like JT, we had a good, you know, conversation, whereas with Tara, we didn't. But I'm hoping that it was helpful for all of the victims to talk about it again. That's for sure.
I mean, this fake Tegan person who's carrying on these relationships with fans who are trying to reach out to you, to a certain degree, they must have been a bit convincing. Do you, like, reading this stuff back, were you surprised at the sort of intuitive nature of this person? I'm reminded of that movie, that Melissa McCarthy movie, Can You Ever Forgive Me, where she's imitating these literary voices and then selling them out. And right. It's like, you read it back and you're like, I'm like, I both would believe it and wouldn't believe it in retrospect, you know?
Well, I mean, I know myself best. And so, no, one of the things that really struck me in 2011, when we first started reading through, you know, dozens of these victims' emails, was that it didn't sound like me. Mm-hmm. You know, I am a very formal, like my friends make fun of me for it. I'm very formal over email and text. I use full punctuation, like an indentation, like, you know, like I didn't look at the emails and say, oh, this sounds like me. But how would they know that? Like, how would Tegan and Sarah fans know what my emails look like? How would they know that I'm, you know, a proper English, you know, using full punctuation? Like, why would they know that? So, no, I didn't feel that that the emails felt like me. And that was such a consolation or such a relief at the time, because I thought, okay, this person's not in my email. They're not pretending to be me with actual, like the stories they would tell were not based on my real life, you know, like it'd be like, oh, I'm cat sitting for my friend Darren and I hate cats. Or like, there's something in the movie where it says like, you know, I got a television finally. It's like, I've always had a television, you know, like it's just like details that didn't make any sense. And that was a relief to us, because we were like, okay, this person doesn't actually seem to know much about my real life. So then we became obsessed with figuring out, okay, well, this is them. Like, they must be making these stories up because that this is actual things that they are doing. So, you know, we fell down the rabbit hole of trying to figure out who fake Tegan was really early, because it became kind of a game. Okay, oh, they've been cat sitting and they have a friend named Darren, and they spell recognize with an S, not a Z. Like, you know, so is it possible they're British? You know, we became, you know, basically internet sleuths. But they did have a lot of things they shouldn't have had access to, you know, unreleased songs, photos, passport scans, personal information about me, like, a you know, about a breakup or about my mom's sister being sick with cancer, stuff like that. And that scared us. You know, that's when we started to realize, like, there were leaks. And at that point determined they had broken into one of our manager's emails, had set up auto forwarding. So they were getting one-sided conversations from our management and us. They had broken onto our manager's iDisk, which for the kids listening is, you know, a version of the iCloud back in that time, or the cloud, basically. And so they did have access, but it was limited. But it was enough to sell this. And in conjunction with the fact that I was just very open, you know, at that time, you know, when this all started, you know, I was willing to stop and talk to people outside the venue and chat and ask them stories. And we would do VIP and record stores. And, you know, we had FaceTime with fans a lot. And so I got to know people. And so they, when we started to interview a lot of the super fans and a lot of the early victims, they were like, you know, it felt weird that you were on Tumblr making friends with fans. But there was this other part of us that was like, well, Tegan's really friendly. And I was like, oh, my God, this is my fault. You know, I was too nice.
You know, it's interesting that this documentary came out when it did. You know, I think that we've had an entire summer, obviously, of this conversation with Chapel Roan bringing this up, with, you know, sort of the boundaries between fans and invasions of privacy, and even just the music and the demos thing. You know, I think about artists that I love, like Charlie XCX. You know, I'm wearing her sweater now. Like, she completely abandoned a project, XCX World, because it leaked online. Yeah. And she didn't want to release it anymore because the demos had gotten out to fans. I remember 2022, I think, like, Lana Del Rey's, like, car was broken into and her computer was stolen, you know? So how do you feel, you know, as an artist, you know, one, fans are constantly wanting access to not just your personal information, but your art before you're ready to share it. And also, you know, how would you offer advice to other artists like Chapel, especially like a queer artist like that, who are experiencing many of these things that you experienced in an early era of the internet too? Now it's, I guess, easier for her fans to even get information about her family and her whereabouts.
Yeah, it has been a crazy few months. I've been joking that it's like as if I know Chapel and text her and was like, is there any way that you could sort of have a meltdown about fandoms and toxicity online just in time for our movie to come out so you could set the scene? But, you know, I mean, I'll say a couple things. Like, the first is that, I mean, we've been dealing with this our whole career for sure. Like, there's definitely an intrusion and entitlement that a certain very small minority of your fan base always has. And every band feels that way. Every public figure feels that way. And you just learn to deal with it. And I am really inspired by this new generation of artists. You know, Chapel is a great example, but Mitski obviously pulled back a couple years ago and no longer runs her own social media and has changed the way that she promoted her latest project. You know, Hayley Williams from Paramore during the pandemic did the same. This is something I think artists have always been going through. I mean, we toured with Katy Perry 10 years ago, and you know, this is someone who has to spend probably 6 or 7 figures a year on security. No artist wants to do that. They're not enjoying that. They're not like, oh, I love going to dinner and then coming out and 100 people are taking photos of me. It's embarrassing. It's irritating. And we're trained as artists not to tell you that. We're trained not to say you're just as bad as the paparazzi to certain people. Like, you know, I've been at a restaurant where someone's filming me eating. It's not pleasant. You're not like, oh, I'm popular, this is cool. You're like, that's annoying, I'm eating. Like, you know, I'm a garbage troll, leave me alone. Like, you know, and so finding the balance for each artist is unique and different. It's your journey, figuring out where you want it to be. Chapel's telling us that her journey is not going to be populated with people like this. She is not going to accept that. And I think it's amazing and inspiring. I think for Sarah and I, we sucked it up and took a lot more abuse and, you know, dealt with the irritation and resentment we sometimes felt by setting more boundaries. But ultimately, you know, we were trained not to say anything. And I don't know that that's right. I just know that that's the generation we come from. I'd say my advice is that you should set the boundaries for your own career. It's your journey, you know, like popularity and fame is unnatural and it's a cycle. I just actually recently listened to Katy Perry talk about this. There's a time in your career where it's really hot. And it doesn't mean you have to be stratospherically popular the way that Chappell has or the way Katy experienced fame. There's a point even in our own career where it was too much and you just pull back and it's a cycle and you come out the other side and you think, whew, I made it through that. And, you know, in terms of technical, you know, advice, change your passwords, make it really difficult. Don't put your name in your own email. You know, your management and your whole entire team and crew, everybody should be regularly changing passwords on social media, on your email. I mean, we've worked with cybersecurity specialists multiple times in our career to help secure our devices. Don't send music over the internet. And just be prepared for it all to leak anyway, because I don't understand. It's like some sort of black magic or something. They get in anyway. You know, it's bed bugs, but...
Every album leaks. Truly. I'm shocked when a pop star's album does not leak at least a couple days before.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really crazy. So it's the world we live in, but... it's so important, though, to remember that the vast majority of human beings and the vast majority of fans aren't like this, you know?
Yeah.
And... I also think we have to zoom out and just say, like, this is a cultural thing. Like, you know, Princess Diana died because the paparazzi were chasing her, but we're the ones that clicked and bought those newspapers. Like, Justin Bieber's been begging us all to leave him alone for years. Like, we are monsters. We, as a culture, are monsters. We love famous people and we drive them crazy. And we drive other human beings to drive them crazy, to capitalize and monetize. And, yeah, that's like, it's dark. That's dark. And that's ultimately what Fanatical, our movie, ended up feeling more like. You know, Aaron Lee Carr, our amazing director, understood, I think, three quarters of the way through. We weren't really talking about fake Tegan or unmasking fake Tegan. We were there to talk about this whole conversation about when people love you too much.
It should not be controversial to say that, yeah, people treat celebrities like shit. We talk about this on Keep It a lot. Like the idea that, like, celebrities have asked for a certain amount of attention and that means they should expect and want to feel invaded is just so wild. But I guess one of my last questions for you is, like, 10 or 11 years ago or so, it was like the New Now Next Awards. And I remember you guys were performing and there was a red carpet that I was working, and Kylie Minogue was asked who she was excited to see, and she said, you guys. And I was just wondering, in general, speaking of fans and that you would actually want to have who aren't horrifying, have you had any fellow artists who've reached out and said that they're fans of yours that you particularly cherish?
Well, that, I remember that moment so vividly. I mean, that was, we went out and danced afterwards, like when we were playing Closer at the end of that award show and Kylie was out there dancing. And it was like, it was very exciting. You know, that era of Tegan and Sarah, like that pop era was really exciting. And I look back on it very fondly, even though we have been slowly like walking it back since, because we didn't really love the pop era that much. I mean, I love the music, but it was too hard. It was too much work. Didn't enjoy that part of it. But, yeah, so many amazing artists. Like, you know, I've obviously brought up Katy a couple times. She was like an incredible fan, you know, very supportive and really helped us a lot during that era. You know, same with Taylor Swift. You know, since we put out Fanatical, I mean, I love Muna. I've been a fan since day one. We've collaborated with them before and they came to the movie premiere in LA and were really supportive. I know they're going through a lot of fan, you know, growth issues right now. And I've been really felt really touched by a lot of the artists that have reached out. I just was texting with Katy from Waxahachie, you know, who'd watched the film. And, you know, there's a lot of really amazing female artists who are incredibly supportive to us and who I look up to and really appreciate, you know, their support in this. But yeah, I mean, honestly, any musician that reaches out and is like, I like your band, I'm like, oh, thank God. I'm clearly, for anyone who watches the movie, I'm hungry for love. So, you know, like I love when our peers reach out and tell us that they appreciate us. It's really meaningful to me. I love being in a band and I love getting to make music. And I love that our music has influenced so many of these new young artists that are coming up. And I just really appreciate that we still get to be at the party all these years later. You know, it's so genuine that I cannot believe Sarah and I did this. We were just back in Calgary and I'm like, God, we were such losers. We were such little dirtbags, you know, like we were like, and the fact that we were like, have pulled this off, it's, yeah, I just feel a lot of gratitude.
It's so weird looking back even on that era, like Lewis bringing up, you know, like back when I had first moved to LA too, you know, the heartthrob era, it is, it feels so distant, but that was really just a big sort of cultural moment. And I, you know, I think Closer, Heartthrob, and even I Love You to Death right after that, just like really big moments that are so different from the So Jealous era. I think it's great that you've been able to have so many different cultural moments that mean so much to different fans.
And I mean, and it means a lot to us too. I mean, I think I watch a lot of artists try to chase past successes, and I understand the desire to do so. I've had so many conversations with amazing bands who feel that their audience just wouldn't accept something different from them. And for Sarah and I, that was, I think that's the key to longevity, and it's certainly been the key to our success and our longevity, which is that when we start the process of making something new, we demolish what we've done in the past. We, you know, truly pack it up, put it in the storage unit. It's like, I don't want to try to recapture anything. For us, it's always about trying to do something new, and not necessarily something new that we think people will love. It's just something new for us to entertain us. So yeah, but I'm so grateful for all the different eras, and that, you know, that Heartthrob era was really exciting, and it's a thrill to talk to, you know, so many different artists who are coming up now and are popular now saying, you know, I mean, it makes me feel hella old, but you know, like when it was like, you know, like we were listening to you guys in high school when you put out Heartthrob and it inspired us, you know, to start a band. I'm like, God, oh my God, we're so old, but I'm thrilled, you know, like I'm truly thrilled to see like these artists thriving. And I feel like genuine excitement to see so many, queer pop stars breaking out and to see so many, female artists doing so well right now. It's a really inspiring time in music, and it's a joyful time for Sarah and I, because it was a lonely career in the early days of Tegan and Sarah. You know, it was really hard, which is, you know, to bring it back to Fanatical, is why I think we had such a connection with our audience, is because they were our peers. They were our mentors. They were the people we looked forward to seeing. They were the ones who made us get on stage every night, because before the social media, we had no way of knowing other bands. Like, there was no one for us. So these days, we're like weirdos. I see, you know, an artist across the festival, and I'm just like, oh my God, we have to go over and introduce ourselves. Like, you know, for me, like, you know, making that community so important. So anyway, yeah, it's a great time in music right now.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And I don't know how this news will fall on your ears, but you are a dynamite interviewee as a solo act. I don't know what this means for Tegan and Sarah, but I mean... I'm a little worried and thrilled for you. So I don't know.
Yeah. Look, Sarah had a kid 2 years ago. So, you know, she's got her hands full. So, you know, if anything, she'd probably be thrilled to know that I'm carrying the weight for both of us sometimes. Cause you know, she's got a busy schedule, so she doesn't have as much time for these things. So, I'll take it. And it's lovely to see both of you again and to speak to you. Thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Of course.
Thank you. Award season just started, but this year's standout might already be decided. Of course, we're talking about Anora, the Sean Baker film that has both critics and audiences raving, that has possibly introduced us to our next big starlet, Mikey Madison. I'm in love with this Cinderella story, okay? This is a 5-star movie for me.
I would say it is a 3-star movie for me, because I find the middle portion a bit repetitive and a bit long. But otherwise, the performances, this is a movie. Mikey Madison plays an exotic dancer with Russian heritage who meets this very rich Russian kid of indiscriminate age, I believe. He claims to be 23, but that's a whole part of the story. He is this goofy, utterly spoiled, utterly uninhibited kid. And he keeps paying her to come over, and eventually he pays her to marry him. And even though it's an arranged marriage like that, they do have some real affection there. But then, unfortunately, they're hanging out one day, and his parents come realizing that he's married this exotic dancer, and they want to force them apart, and they hire these hitmen type people. They aren't hitmen, but they're like scary repo men vibes to come and arrange this for them. And it's about her resisting that after he runs off and they can't find him. It's just, it's a Pretty Woman story that turns into this kind of gangster caper. And it is very entertaining throughout. The final moment of the movie is particularly touching and well acted. But I have to say about this movie, I do prefer the Pretty Woman section to the gangster section. I thought the beginning of the movie, like the basically just the setup for the real problem in the story, is the best part of it. Not just because she is so charming and he is so fucking hilarious. I'm sorry, he should be nominated for an Oscar too, for supporting actor. Obviously, a lot of awards attention is being paid to Mikey Madison. Excuse me, Mark Edelstein as Vanya in this movie. When the movie begins, I think, oh, he's on equal footing with Mikey Madison in terms of screen time. This should be a Best Actor nomination. The way the movie goes and the way you feel about that character, something shifts, but that's not because the performance is bad. He is amazing in this movie, and he better get a Best Supporting Actor nomination for this movie. Mark Edelstein. I hope you hear his name again. But it sort of reminds me of my friend Rachel Fields, who lives in Madison, Wisconsin, has a problem with rom-coms, and she's an obsessive rom-com fan. She goes, do we have to get to the problem? Can we just hang out and you guys are like liking each other? Like, that's fun, you know? You sort of resent that they have to get involved with plot, get involved with problems.
You know, I would say that I enjoyed all three movies that this was. There's the Pretty Woman part in the beginning.
The courting, the, yeah. The hangout, there's a lot of charming and whining and dining, etc.
It's very Gen Z Pretty Woman Cinderella story. It's coked out. It's frenetic. It is Spring Breakers-esque.
Yes.
It's hustlers on steroids. It is so fucking fun. The dialogue is great. The characters are great. It's an amazing setup for a story. I love the caper, the mob shit in the center, mostly because I still think it's so fucking funny still. You've gotten to know these characters and then you introduce these mob-type goons who come in and set off her, but then also set off some of the other characters that you've been introduced to. I love character actress Ivy Walk, who's in this, who plays one of the friends. You see her in the candy store. You see her on the trip to Vegas.
She is very funny, yes.
She also has a part in English Teacher. She's so fucking funny. And she loves Keep It. She loves both of us.
Oh, never mind. She's the world's greatest. Yes.
Shout out to Ivy. But what I love about the caper, too, was that I at first was so worried that it was going to be Uncut Gems vibes, because Safdie Brothers movies stress me out.
Right.
I'm sorry. Like Uncut Gems does, the Robert Pattinson one, High Life.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that stresses me the fuck out. I'm sorry. Like, it just does. And I was so worried that this was going to stress me out too, but it never really does. It teeters on the edge of that, but it manages to be funny and not sort of skin crawling. So that's great. And then I think what the movie becomes in the third act is so much fucking fun. I mean, it's almost Dynasty-esque in the third act of the film.
Meaning what?
I just think, you know, like, I don't want to spoil stuff, but, you know, like with the arrival of the parents and then, you know, like the court and then like the Vegas stuff, it's very like wrapping up the story in a very like melodramatic fun way.
Yeah. So the middle portion, the caper, the things I have some quibbles with. I will say, like, so it's the goons and then her. She begins to assert herself, saying she doesn't have to annul or get divorced from this guy. She made the decision herself and they're like acting on behalf of this rich family. So there's this big conflict. It's a lot of yelling the word motherfucker at each other. Now, okay, there's a place for that in cinema. That said, it goes on for quite a while, and it makes me feel like I'm watching a Rob Zombie movie. I don't know if you've ever seen The Devil's Rejects.
Absolutely.
Where they say the F word something like 750,000 times. I think it's still a record. It felt like that for a little while.
That's true. You know what? I will say that as a writer, sometimes you stop yourself from writing fuck in a movie so many times because you will read it back and you say, what are my characters doing here? I wish they would say anything else. But it feels like that's all that's in her repertoire.
Yeah. No, I will say they something that kind of impresses me about this movie is so Anora is the star character, but she is never given lines that feel overly scripted or overly quippy or like she's suddenly Dorothy Parker out of nowhere. Like it does commit to the kind of person she actually would be. There is no contrived dialogue in this movie, even though I do believe the dialogue gets repetitive. So I both respect what happens to the movie midway through and then also sort of wish it gave us something else.
Yeah. Have you ever seen Three from Hell? The
no.
sequel to Devil's Rejects?
No, imagine me watching a sequel to that fucking movie. Yes, more, I said. My friend Elise, who was just visiting over the weekend, was the one who showed that to me. Bitch, come on, Elise. You know that's not my bag. Yeah.
When you think about Rob Zombie doing the Halloween movies, I wonder if there's a person who could do the reverse of that. Take a Rob Zombie movie like The Devil's Rejects and make like the classier, like Halloween version of that for you.
Oh, yes. Thank you. Yes. I would love an lightly anesthetized, less, I mean, talk about Safdie Brothers. That is one of the most fraught movies I've ever seen, Devil's Rejects.
Yeah. Anyway, Mikey Madison is great in this movie. Mark Idlestein, the kid, is great in the movie, but I love Yuri Borisov, who plays one of the goons, and I don't want to spoil too much about his role, but when he first appears in the movie, I sort of clock him as an interesting actor, and I was pleasantly surprised that they give him a lot more to do in the movie, because he, I think, is also really great in the movie.
Is that Igor?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. He is great. I don't know that I'm disappointed. I kind of wish he didn't play as crucial a role as he ends up playing in the movie. It's like they gave a kind of comic relief character this other dimension. I question how much that worked, even though he was great in the role. But by the way, the main goon, Tauros or whatever, he was fucking good too. And his vibe to me is the dad from Clueless. Dan Hedaya. One of the great 90s performances.
I mean, great scene at the fucking christening.
Oh my God. This guy, he gets the text that this kid is married or whatever, and he's like sent into action to go after him, and he's in the middle of a christening, like holding the baby, and just hands the baby off and leaves the church and says sorry one time as he leaves. So funny.
So now, having experienced Anora, how would you say this stacks up against the rest of Sean Baker's films, and how are you starting to feel about Sean Baker as a filmmaker?
Well, you know what I'll say? You know what Sean Baker is excellent at? Establishing a zany character and then letting them go. Like they're off on a caper and like it's you're clutching your face and there's some wild nudity you didn't expect or a wild confrontation you didn't expect, whatever. I think this is his most complete and satisfying movie in terms of a character arc. That said, I think the best performance in a Sean Baker movie is still former Keep It guest Simon Rex in Red Rocket. I thought he was absolutely spectacular in that movie. I don't mean to say she is worse than he is, but I thought he was should have been a shoo-in for a Best Actor nomination that year. Mikey Madison in this, the attitude she gives, I mean, it's sort of like if you gave the entire My Cousin Vinny, Marissa Tomei character, like, a real caper for her to go on and not just one witness stand speech.
Yeah. Whereas I am not worried about Mikey getting a nomination.
As in you think she will?
I think she absolutely will.
Oh, definitely. No, she's a contender to win. She's just a brand new entity in the Best Actress vocabulary. And when she's up against someone like Angelina Jolie in this Maria Callas movie we're getting from Pablo Larraín, and Nicole Kidman in Baby Girl, which we both have seen. And she is phenomenal in it. But I wonder if that movie is... It's interesting comparing Mikey Madison and Nicole Kidman. Nicole Kidman is someone you want to have two Oscars. So I feel like that's what puts her in the pole position right now. But that movie is also slightly conventional in terms of being an affair movie. And this movie is not conventional. And I feel like the character of Anora... And again, please always play the title character when you can. Because that is Oscar gold. Anyway, comparing those two, it's very interesting right now.
I also am maybe anticipating a nomination for Sean Baker finally.
Yes, I guess he is under reward. The only acting nomination so far for a Sean Baker movie, I believe, is Willem Dafoe in The Florida Project, and he was great in that movie. Also, I think that might be my favorite of his movies.
The Florida Project is great. I mean, Tangerine is just fun.
Yeah.
Fun in general. What I love about this film, too, is I think Alyssa Wilkinson mentions this in her review of it, but that there's moments when they're walking on the boardwalk in Anora, and you can see sort of like the orange sunset behind them, and it's so gorgeous, just the staging of it. And I would say that one thing that Sean Baker does beautifully is filming someone walking, like on a mission. Yeah. Tangerine is all walk.
Tangerine especially, yeah. The end of Florida Project when they go to Disney. Yeah, yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
Someone on a mission in a Sean Baker film is always going to be maybe the most mesmerizing part of the movie.
This is not one of his movies, but it's sort of like in Sideways when Paul Giamatti leaves that house and that naked guy comes after him. That energy to me is a Sean Baker movie. Of like movement and walking and craziness and what the fuck is going on.
Whenever I think of Sideways, I always think of the 30 Rock joke now.
Which was?
Liz Lemon saying, remember I asked that black guy if he had seen Sideways?
She's a mess. Never not good to rewatch. Never not good.
I mean, I love when people are always discussing 30 Rock online, but I feel like it should be new information to people, but people are always discovering that Liz Lemon is supposed to be bad at her job.
Right. Or like a kind of a bumblefuck. And also, people have really honed in on the fact that the show she writes is so bad.
It is bad. TGS is bad.
Right. But also, it's like, that's true to life, because it's like, somebody would cynical and smart like her would be writing a show that's like meant to be like dog food for the masses. Like, it does make sense, you know?
Yeah, I think it was brought up, especially in the context of Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, if you can recall, Mr. Sorkin.
Mr. Sorkin has been typing again. There you go. Yeah.
Yeah, about how that show was, they really tried to make the comedy on that show brilliant.
And let me tell you something. The writings and my eyes don't lie.
Yeah. So, Anora, 5 stars from me. Thumbs up. Go and see Anora.
Definite thumbs up. Between 3 and 3.5 stars for me. I really enjoyed the movie.
Also, Mikey Madison, like I said, one of my favorite ghost faces in the Scream franchise. I think that what people think that Emma Roberts does, and I love Emma Roberts in Scream 4, obviously, but Mikey Madison just gives you so much in that kitchen scene. It's fantastic, and it almost makes me wish for, okay, you're not a big Saw person, but
sure, I'm not.
But the Saw movies, what they do is they jump out of chronology. And so sometimes, some of the twists in some of the early ones were, oh, this is taking place in the past or something, but sometimes they jump back and forth in time, right? So that Tobin Bell can still be alive.
Yeah.
And I would love, there's just so much going on in the Scream universe, and we have so many great killers who are dead. Let's just go back. Give us a movie that takes place like between Scream 4 and 5.
But also, again, and that reminds me of my favorite thing about Ghostface, no matter who is in the costume, Ghostface is 6'3" and wearing huge boots, and that includes Mikey Madison.
You can never figure out who that bitch is.
No. No, defies space and time. But where is, by the way, let's say Scream actually happened, and Scream, well, I'm Nev or whatever, and so the person in the costume is somebody I know. I would know who it is based on how they move in the costume. Like, that. This is like something that never occurs to the people in Scream. Like, oh, they're moving like my friend, or they're jolting, or they're athletic in a particular way. Anyway, these are things that would come to mind if you were actually being stalked by a killer in this costume.
Also, this way too much hesitation with ripping the mask off immediately when the killer is knocked out for a second.
Right. No, please take it off. Please, our problems would be solved. Please. Yeah.
All right. When we're back, keep it. And we are back with our favorite segment of the episode. It's Keep It Lewis?
Yes.
What's yours?
My first keep it goes to battleground states that are stressing me the fuck out right now. What I would like everybody to do is to think of three friends they know in a battleground state and text those people. And first of all, say hi or just skip hi. Who cares? And make sure they go and vote because, as you may have understood, it's going to come down to those states this election. You can go to votesaveamerica.com/vote to get actual language you can use to share with these people that will compel them to vote. So you don't even have to do the creative writing yourself. You can hand that on. You can outsource that to Crooked Media and all the wonderful people who work there. My actual keep it this week.
Mm-hmm.
This weekend, Joni Mitchell performed at the Hollywood Bowl with her puppeteer, Brandi Carlile. And
I saw a lot of Instagrams. Yeah. People were like, I'm going to see Joni.
Right. And she did two shows. She was apparently amazing. Also at the show, Elton John was in the background, basically running backup or whatever. And also Meryl Streep. Meryl Streep, as you may have heard, is rumored to be playing Joni Mitchell in a biopic written by Cameron Crowe, who has become friends with Joni Mitchell over the years. He did a famous interview with her in the 70s and had a wonderful review of Blue when it came out at the time. That's 1971. But in the years since, he's written a version of a biopic that takes place later in life. I'm just going to say keep it to that. I just don't know that I can watch Meryl Streep do late stage Joni Mitchell. I will say I want Meryl Streep to get Oscar number 4. And I'm also going to say I would like Meryl to return to the silver screen. She hasn't been in a movie since Don't Look Up. What? Meryl, you cannot leave us with that movie. Unacceptable. Unacceptable. And by the way, Only Murders in the Building can't be what you spend all your time doing. I'm sorry. Like, let's get it together. Let's get back to the silver screen where you belong. Cate Blanchett's on television now. We've lost our morals. Yeah. We've lost our morals. But
first of all, that building, does Sart run the lease for it? Because how many actors have they trapped in that no exit of a building?
Yeah, no. It's horrifying.
Everyone's on that show.
Right. And nope, to save her own life, presumably, she's now with Martin Short. Guys, I was onto that first. I was not onto it second. I was onto it first. They're holding hands, going out to restaurants in Venice and stuff. Anyway, Joni Mitchell's life is fascinating. I just feel like I would rather see the biopic of the young Joni, which is allegedly part of the story that Cameron Crowe has written. But also, you know, I distrust him a little bit. His last movie was Aloha. He trapped us in Elizabethtown for a little while. So you never know what you're going to get with him. It's been a long time since Almost Famous. You know what I mean?
Obviously, Meryl could play the blue era Joni.
No.
Anyway.
I wonder who that would be now. Yeah, because Joni Mitchell at that time would have been in her late 20s. So, who would the person be who's... Riley Keogh? I have no idea. Remember for a time, we were supposed to get a Taylor Swift performance as Joni Mitchell in a biopic, and then Joni Mitchell herself said, all you've done is found a girl with high cheekbones. Wow, well, in your face, bitch.
Honestly, I think that Zoe Kravitz could play the black era of Joni Mitchell.
Ira has a condition where every time Joni Mitchell comes up, he has to bring up Joni Mitchell in blackface on the cover of Don Juan's Reckless Daughter, her worst album.
I only bring it up because, unfortunately, the pictures kind of look fly.
No, she picked a character. I'll say that.
She was jiving.
Yeah.
I want to know who else was at that party.
Yeah. The clothes were great, too.
Same thing as I would love a movie set at the roast where Ted Danson is in blackface.
Oh, with Whoopi Goldberg. One of the great relationships of all time. No disrespect to Miss Steenburgen, but.
Yeah. Let Ryan Murphy excavate that. Those kind of salacious stories.
It really, the pictures are just so shocking because it's the 90s. I want to be clear. It's like, modern times. Anyway, Ira, what is your keep it this week?
Yeah. Also, by the way, before I move on to that, because I brought up the Mark Wahlberg thing last week about the Calvin Klein ad.
Oh, yeah.
And you just said the 90s. I had forgotten, this is also in the Mark Wahlberg ad. I had forgotten how in the 90s, it was a common thing for everyone to just always say, it's the 90s.
Oh, yeah. I remember on Clarissa they did that. Ferguson would say that. Like, it's the 90s. And I was like, that has no meaning whatsoever, right? You're just in a decade. Go ahead.
Yeah. All right. My keep it this week. Last week, Cynthia Erivo.
Oh, God. This is so much already. Go ahead.
Cynthia Erivo was a little upset with some fan edits of the Wicked poster. Now, here's what happened. The Wicked poster, which has Cynthia Erivo on it wearing a witch's hat and fully showing her face, and one of Ariana Grande sort of whispering to her with a crown on, is the official movie poster.
Correct.
Now, for years, the Broadway poster has not shown, you know, either Glinda or Elphaba's faces. It's just sort of had the hat tipped down, and then it's also just had a white hat over Glinda whispering to Elphaba's ear. That's been in the iconic image of Wicked since 2003.
And they did that because different people play those characters. So you don't want to see their faces. Yes.
So what happened is someone made a fan edit of the poster to look like the iconic Wicked poster. Cynthia Erivo was not a fan.
No.
And she posted about it saying, "This is the wildest, most offensive thing I have seen," which is crazy.
The number one thing?
Which is crazy because Cynthia Erivo read the script to Harriet. Equal to that awful AI of us fighting, equal to people posing the question, "Is your pussy green?"
Which is a reference to a meme. We'll get to that in a second.
"None of this is funny. None of it is cute. It degrades me. It degrades us. The original poster is an illustration. I am a real life human being who chose to look right down the barrel of the camera." Sorry. I'm sorry that I'm laughing, but this is such a response that you would get from a theater actor.
Yes.
"I am a real life human being who chose to look right down the barrel of the camera to you, the viewer, because without words, we communicate with our eyes."
What? I mean, like, okay, I'll say this. If someone manipulated my image, I might have, like, an allergic reaction to that. Whatever. Like, it's an
Absolutely.
Uncomfortable thing to see, etc. It's not like, she's pretending like she made a provocative choice having a face on a poster facing forward. I mean, it's not true. And I'm sure it wasn't her decision. Like, what? Like, of course, somebody art directed this, etc. Now, so if you haven't seen this meme, Glinda is leaning into Elphaba, who of course has green makeup, and she says, the caption is "your pussy green?" Now, I understand that that's a bit profane, a bit vile. Somebody who isn't associated with that joke might not want to be associated with it. I understand where Cynthia Erivo's coming from in that front. But at the same time, the fact that she is leaning in to whisper this, the joke is she's embarrassed it's such an immature, profane question, and that's why the verbiage is what it is. So I'm just saying, like, the joke is on the profanity.
Also, the joke predates this situation. The meme itself comes from the original Wicked poster, which has been around for years. Someone at one point in New York City scrawled graffiti onto the poster in a subway station or something and wrote, "Is your pussy green?" as if Glinda was whispering it to Elphaba. And this has been a meme on the internet for about a decade.
Mm-hmm.
Longer, even.
Right. I will say, though, it is kind of nice watching a theater person, you know, find a keyboard and express whatever, rancor, etc. Just because, you know, in this era of, like, Chapel Roan, I like seeing people respond just with some bitterness. Like, it's like not like you, it's not like you owe us, like, a pleasant face and a smile all the time.
No.
So whatever, like,
be
go
pissed.
Go off, etc. You know, it's just, it's one of those things that puts you in her head, and it's like, oh, that's what you think of this. And it's surprising. It was just a surprising reaction.
Yeah, I'm not discounting her reaction. Be upset, go off. But it was a surprising reaction. And I do think the, you know, the part that turns it into camp is the, I chose to look down the barrel of the camera to you, the viewer, because without words, we communicate with our eyes. I mean, that is giving Carly Kloss looking camp right in the eye.
Remember when she did that? Oh,
yes.
And then from then on, no one knew what camp meant. I believe she was the beginning of the end of the word camp.
I mean, even to Dinner with the Wizard?
It's a reference to the Project Runway episode, even to Dinner with the Kushners. Well done. That was good.
I will say, though, that the person who created the Photoshop pointed out that it was not AI. They actually Photoshopped the image themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So she was wrong about it being AI. But I will say that they reposted it and then said, a lot of people have been taking credit for this, and I know that she's upset, but I'm reposting it so that I can get credit for this image. Which means, well, I guess you don't care about her being upset.
Yeah, right. Allow me to have more of a moment with this. Thank you.
Also, I mean, it's not that good.
No, I wasn't marveling at it. I was like, someone get her a job at a firm.
If Cynthia Erivo had come out and said, it looks ugly, that would have made more sense, because it does look ugly. Because the Photoshop, which hides her eyes, it doesn't then alter Ariana Grande's image at all to look like the original poster.
Right. Yeah. So it's half-assed in a way.
Yeah, it's half-assed. I will say the other funny part of this story is that at the 4th annual Academy Museum Gala in LA on Saturday, Ariana Grande was asked about this on the red carpet. Of course she was.
Yes.
And she gave a very Glinda response. I think it's very complicated because I find AI so conflicting and troublesome sometimes, but I think it's just kind of such a massive adjustment period. This is something that is so much bigger than us, and the fans are going to have fun and make their edits. And asked if things can go too far sometimes, she says, I think so, and I have so much respect for my sister Cynthia, and I love her so much. It's just a big adjustment period. It's so much stimulation about something that's so much bigger than us. Go ahead, girl. She didn't say anything, but she said everything.
What's bigger? What? We're small? What?
It's bigger than our body.
Yeah.
John Mayer.
All right, yeah. It was like approaching saying something, and then I came away with less than what I walked in with.
The statement was, my sister's doing a little bit too much, but I love her, and you're not about to catch me up on this carpet.
Right, yes.
That was the statement.
By the way, again, please just say, you're not going to catch me up on this carpet. Go ahead and say it to somebody's face. Shutting down reporters, I think, is very in vogue right now.
That's what I mean when I say I miss R&B Ariana. I miss Ariana's Black era, speaking of Black periods in pop stars, because there was a period in time when Ariana would say on a red carpet to a reporter, you're not about to catch me up on this carpet. Walk away.
Right. One of my favorite moments ever is when Kurt Loder of MTV fame confronted Jewel about her poetry book and the usage of a word in it. She used the word casualty to mean one thing. It doesn't really mean that thing. And she goes, you're a real asshole for saying that. Next question. Bam. Yeah.
Imagine asking me about the use of a word in my poetry book on a red carpet.
Kurt Loder expected Alaskan lady decorum from Jewel, and he got run over by the van she was raised in.
The van she was still sleeping in.
Yeah. Amazing voice. Jewel is underrated in terms of the canon of vocalists.
I love Jewel. We need a Jewelissance.
Yeah. I'll sing Intuition right now.
It is wild that is maybe my biggest Jewel pop culture moment. Intuition and the Schick Razor commercial, and also something that means absolutely nothing to anyone not our age.
No, right. You had to have been there. It's like the Liz Phair pop album. It's like, all that, the garbage pop album, etc.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for listening to our show this week. You know, as we stared the podcast mic down
the barrel
to you, down the barrel to you, the listener,
which you couldn't even see because you're only hearing this. So,
yeah,
defying space and time over here. And thank you to Teek and Quinn for being here. What an awesome interviewee.
Yeah. And if you have not seen it yet, go and watch Fanatical. It is on Hulu.
See you next week.
Don't forget to follow Crooked Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok.
You can also subscribe to Keep It on YouTube for access to full episodes and other exclusive content. And if you're as opinionated as we are, consider dropping us a review.
Keep It is a Crooked Media production. Our producers are Chris Lord and Kennedy Hill. Our executive producers are Ira Madison III, Louis Vertel, and Kendra James.
Our digital team is Megan Patzel, Claudia Shang, and Rachel Gajewski. This episode was recorded and mixed by Evan Sutton. Thank you to Matt DeGroat, David Tolles, Kyle Seglin, and Charlotte Landis for production support every week.
Celine Dion is having a moment. It's certainly not her first, and millions of fans are hoping it won't be her last. While Celine's international stardom seems obvious now, it was all so unlikely.
Celine, Understood from CBC, is a four-part series that explores the surprising cultural, political, and business alchemy that created one of the most enduring superstars the planet has ever seen, and one of the best Anna Gasteyer impressions of our lifetime. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.